again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Daily Caller Podcast for the 22nd day of November 2019. Friday. Thank God it's Friday. Oh, I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. Thank you for downloading, listening, telling a friend, spreading the word. We're growing like a fungus. And some people probably think we are a fungus. And it's all thanks to you. You are the appropriate atmosphere for us to grow. It's a special edition of the program, ladies and gentlemen. As we always do on Friday, we have our interview. This one is a long interview, and it's an excellent interview with Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And I know some of you, you hear National Review, you roll your eyes, and you go, oh, National Review, never Trump. No. It's actually, we talk a lot about the president, and he reminds me, because I remembered plain as day the cover of National Review that said never Trump, and it was their big editorial, and then he said no. It didn't say that, and then I remembered. Oh yes, it said against Trump. I was wrong. He was right. But we talk about his book. We talk about nationalism. We talk about the virtues of President Trump. We talk about the failures of the Democratic Party. You're just going to have to listen to the interview and judge for yourself. Judge for yourself. I think at the end of it, you will find that maybe your mind isn't necessarily changed, but it's altered a little bit, which I realize is the same thing, but still, give it a listen. It's an interesting conversation in any event. We spend a lot of time talking about the left and the dangers and pitfalls of the left, and you will like it. Plus, at the end, you get a chance to win a signed copy of his book, which I'll give away the week after Thanksgiving, because next week is a short week, and I just want to give people a chance to digest it and possibly enter to win longer than 3 days. I also will announce the winner of the signed Jerome Hudson books, the two signed copies of Jerome Hudson's book, at the end of this program after the interview. So you have to listen to the interview anyway to find out if you won, unless you fast forward, which would be cheating. And you're not a cheater. You're not a cheater, are you? No, you're not a cheater. So, yeah, there is one thing I want to get to before we get to the interview about Chris Cuomo making a complete clown of himself. But before I get to that, hear me out on this Life Change Tea stuff. I'm telling you, it is a big deal. It is a difference maker in your health. Your body, what you put into your body matters. And the ability of your body to absorb what you put into your body food-wise matters even more. And what you've got going on inside of you right now is stuck inside of you. Some of that stuff takes its sweet time to get through you. That's why you need Life Change Tea. It's the tea that makes you go. It'll clean you out. You won't be running to the bathroom every 5 minutes. It's not like that. It is a gentle daily cleanse that cleans you out and allows you to absorb more of the nutrition from the food that you eat. You know, our nutrition has been depleted through processing and God knows what else over the last 50, 60 years. This puts the pep back in your step and it keeps you regular. All you got to do is go to getthetea.com now. That's getthetea.com. Order a tea. They'll send it to you. It tastes great. You brew up like a gallon of it at once. You drink just a little bit every day, so it lasts a long time, and you will see a difference. You'll get more energy. You won't be so run down all the time. You won't be so tired. Look at me. I'm working 17 to 38 hours a day, and here I am, peppy. As peppy as I ever get. Just go to getthetea.com. It helps the program, it helps the company, and it helps you. Enter promo code Derek at checkout, and you get 10% off your order on top of it. Getthetea.com. Check out Life Change Tea. You won't be sorry you did. Now I want to talk about Chris Cuomo, because he just finds new and creative ways to make a fool of himself, doesn't he? Fredo Cuomo was on, there was a panel discussion on CNN, and one of the witnesses that testified yesterday was David Holmes. He's the counselor for political affairs at the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine, apparently, and he's the one who, with dog ears, allegedly overheard the president on the phone with Ambassador Sondland badgering him about, are they going to start the investigation? Are they going to start the investigation? Now, this allegedly took place at a restaurant at lunchtime, so theoretically there would be, you know, people there and noise in the background. And he was saying that the conversation was so loud, that the president was so loud, he was able to hear this conversation. through the earpiece, which was not on speakerphone, of Ambassador Sondland's cell phone. So Chris Cuomo wanted to illustrate just how easy it was to hear a conversation through an earpiece on a cell phone. So he busted out his cell phone and called his mom. And what followed is hilarity, because no one could hear anything. For one brief second in this clip, you will hear his mother's voice. And that is because he put it on speakerphone, which decidedly the conversation that the president was having with Sondland was not on. And he wanted to demonstrate how easily you could hear a phone call. And, well, it's Chris Cuomo. It went about as well as you think.
Very interesting theory from our president that he has really good hearing. Some would say the best hearing ever. And he's never been able to hear a phone call when it wasn't on speakerphone from anybody. So let's just play with that for a second. Mom, can you hear me? All right. So if I were holding the phone here, I'm with Dana Bash. You know how you're always telling me to let her talk because she's so smart and I shouldn't say so much. Can you just say hello? Mom, she probably can't hear me. Mom, can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you. When you talk to me, I hear you.
I'm talking to you. Say hello to Dana Bash.
Hi, Mrs. Cuomo. How are you?
Oh. All right.
So I can't hear your mother, Chris.
Yeah, you're over there. So
I'm sitting across the table.
This is not on speakerphone.
I'm sitting across the table.
It's not on speakerphone. It's regular phone. It's 2 feet away from Dana. She can hear my mother. I'm not sure Mom can hear us. Mom, thank you very much. Thank you for not saying anything that'll get me in trouble. I'll call you back. I love you. All right.
He's such a clown. He thinks this proves his point, but it actually proves the president's point that this idea is garbage, because Chris Cuomo was not holding the phone to his ear. He was holding it to Dana Bash's face. He was holding it in between them. So obviously she would be able to make out vaguely what she was saying over the phone. But I mean, actually, if Chris Cuomo had held it up to his ear, it would have echoed around inside of his head and out the other side. So it would have probably amplified it. That might have helped quite a bit in the experiment there. But he actually ended up proving the exact opposite point, that nobody could hear it. Nobody who wasn't sitting directly to his right and was having the phone held up to their face could hear his mother over the non-speakerphone cell phone, let alone be able to make out clearly what was being said. Because if you do hold it to your head and you're not Chris Cuomo, and that means it won't rattle around inside your head and be amplified out the other ear, it means that the sound will be directed inside your ear, therefore making it more difficult to hear what was being said over the phone. It's such a clown that CNN thinks they've got themselves a bit of gold right here. Oh, baby, we got ourselves a gold mine here. We've proven Trump a liar. No, Fredo, you've proven yourself to be a damned moron. Again, I mean, not exactly breaking news. Anyway, I had to play that. It wouldn't wait until Monday. I just had to get that out there in case you hadn't seen it, hadn't heard it. It's a problem with any show, and the timing is something happens immediately and you're like, I want to tell the world. And you're like, oh, crap, the world's going to have to wait until the morning to hear this. And the world may have heard everything, heard the clip, seen the clip, heard somebody's analysis who's similar. The only difference is nobody's analysis is anywhere close to mine. I bet nobody made the echoing around and bouncing out and amplifying in his head joke that I did. Anyway, a man whose head is not empty and will not echo around, bounce around, and amplify anything is Rich Lowry. He's the editor of National Review. And starting now, after this, I will play the interview we had with him about his new book, Defense of Nationalism. It's a very interesting conversation, very interesting and important and helpful book for all you people out there who don't know, are afraid of being called, you're a nationalist. So what? What's wrong with that? Nothing, actually. And he explains it in the book and in the interview. And then after the interview, I will come back with the winners' names of the signed Jerome Hudson books. So enjoy our interview with Rich Lowry.
All righty. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Daily Caller podcast, the Friday video edition. I am Derek Hunter. I am your Mr. Rourke. I am your host for the show. And as we do every Friday, we bring someone into our world and pick their brains to get to know a little bit more about theirs. This is no different. We're in for a treat. We're joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review and author of the new book, The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. Welcome to the show, Rich.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much. There's
a lot of ground I want to cover, not just about the topic of nationalism, but about the news of the day.
Sure.
It's a little bit difficult because we're on Monday and this won't run till Friday, so everything could have changed by then. We could have died a nuclear holocaust on Wednesday, in which case all will be forgiven for getting it wrong. But let's talk about the book, first of all, nationalism, because the thing about nationalism, it's one of those words that it depends on who's saying it or who's hearing it, mm-hmm. what it means mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. And it's all about the modifiers used to talk
right.
about it. And it's a word that's been polluted. It's a word that's been celebrated, all again, based on the perspective of hearing it. So for the purposes of this discussion, define what nationalism means to you and in this book.
Yeah, okay. So obviously terms mean a lot in this discussion. And a lot of people just assume the word patriotism, that's everything good about national feeling, and nationalism is everything bad. And that's a bad and unsustainable definition. If you get really technical about it, patriotism comes from the Latin root patre, patriarchy, father, fatherland. It's loyalty to your own. Nationalism, more specific, distinct people bonded together, common language, common culture, common history should govern a distinct territory. That's it. And it's a really basic thing. It's very natural thing, very old thing. Talk in the book a little about the example of Joan of Arc. You know, in the 15th century, she has a vision. I'm going to clear the English out of France. And we're going to put a French guy back on the throne of France. And amazingly enough, she does it. The English capture her, burn her at the stake, scatter her ashes in the Seine, you know, never to be heard from again, they hope. But she's become a national symbol. So there, on that basis, she will never die. And various French figures, left, right, in between, glom on to her and her example when they try to liberate France, most famously Charles de Gaulle and the Free French. So this is just something you can't wipe out. And I think in more sort of contemporary political terms, the left totally turned its back on it a while ago and became cosmopolitan progressives, even though they have a nationalistic tradition running through FDR and JFK. And Republicans had lost touch with it under the influence of libertarianism, a business elite that became a little more transnational in its orientation. So they had this baton just sitting on the floor, very powerful, that Trump, whatever, you know, intuitively, accidentally, whatever, consciously or not, picked up on and is used very powerfully.
Why is it so effective? I mean, patriotism is a different thing. The 1980, you show me the 1980 Olympic hockey team
right.
beating the Soviets in
right.
the semifinal rounds. I still tear up.
Right.
I think people who weren't born yet will
right.
still tear up about that. That's patriotism, but nationalism is a little different. They both sort of go to the same reptilian part of our brain that we don't really fully understand. But nationalism is very powerful, both as a motivator and a motivator to be against. Why
right.
why is that?
Well, it's related to that patriotic sentiment. I'm the same way about USA hockey. And sometimes when there's a sports desert, you know, certain times of year, I'll watch highlights from that game. Like the last minute, Al Michaels' call is fantastic.
Yes.
Sometimes I'll back it up and do the last 10 minutes, you know. When
I got the chills you just mentioning Al because it went through my head.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the perfect moment.
Yeah. So, but nationalism, people feel a connection, one, to their countrymen. An example I use when I talk about this is African-American meets a white American on the steps of the Paris Opera House tonight. Instantly, they have more in common than anyone around them.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter whether their politics are different, whether it's from different parts of the country, because they speak English, they dress largely the same, they probably like broadly the same food, and they have this huge common stock of national heroes and common cultural references. So we're bounded together, and people want to feel bounded together. And historically, they want to govern their own territory. especially they want to speak their own language. And if someone else comes to try to take their territory from them or try to impose on them some other system, impose on them from some other language, you get an enormous reaction. And this is why empires never last, because you rope together various nations, but someone has to rule. Mm-hmm. Someone has to rule. Some language is going to be dominant. Some systems and culture is going to be dominant, and everyone else isn't going to like it. And as soon as the repressive apparatus gives way, they fall apart.
I listened to your conversation with Jonah Goldberg, and you seemed almost at different points, you seem to be making different cases and almost working off of different definitions of the word, and it sort of stuck around throughout. But one point that Jonah made that I know that a lot of people who are more left-leaning who are listening or watching will make is, because you talk about common language, a lot of that is done by force. There is imperialism before you can get to nationalism. We were 13 colonies along the coast.
Right.
Now we've manifest destinied ourselves to the other
right.
ocean.
Right.
And in the pursuit of that, we not only vanquished the Spanish, the French, and so on. We're all better for that. We also didn't commit genocide. That's too harsh of a word, but that's the word that would be used in talking about the usurpation or boxing in of native people,
yeah.
and things like that. So when they hear the idea of this, of what you just described, they have that mentality in it's a conquered people. We're a
right.
conquered country. Address
right.
that, if you will.
Well, it's certainly true. We treated the Indians in a duplicitous and cruel way, and it's a national sin on our part. What I say in the book, though, there are really two parts of it. I grant that, which is absolutely true, but then I also say this is a stupendous boon to our nation, which is also, I think, inarguable. But most critics, they'll focus on the first part and say, well, it was really, really bad. And I'll say, I know, I'm saying it was bad. You know, I'm not saying might makes right, because I'm not saying it was right. But that we're a continental nation, it was really important to us. We wouldn't have won two world wars in the 20th century if that hadn't been true. And sadly, I think with Native Americans, someone was going to push them aside just because they're largely a pre-modern people who had run up against a much more powerful and dynamic civilization. If it hadn't been us who had taken the swath of the continent to the west of where we are now, it would have been the Spaniards, it would have been the English, it would have been the French, it would have been the Mexicans, it would have been the Canadians, it would have been someone. And in that context, it was better for us. But to get to the root of your question, the premise, yeah, there is a kind of a cultural to achieve a cultural coherence, it does require an element of coercion or an element of uniformity. Now, the beauty of our system, there's still a lot of give within it. And you have all sorts of distinct cultures. And if federalism is working the right way, you have localities and states that have a large share of their own autonomy in our system. But there has to be some national norm. And if you don't have that, I think that's an enormous risk on the other side of this equation.
It's incredibly important in, you know, just to use the most blatant example, after September 11th, we came together. There was a rush of patriotism and a rush of nationalism. And I don't know how a country could have survived without a healthy dose of both, even though it wasn't labeled nationalism at the time. Yet there seems to be a concerted effort by the left to demonize both in many
right.
ways, but particularly nationalism. And they, I always say we've gone from a melting pot to a series of chafing dishes that they can easily manipulate around
right.
the table, because the divided people are easier to conquer and move around. Why is this? Because it creeps into popular culture and it creeps into people who don't pay attention to the news through popular culture. Why is the case, the fight against nationalism, the concept against of nationalism, the demonization of nationalism, successful, especially when it comes to college campuses, and nefarious, dangerous, worrisome when it
yeah.
comes to national cohesion going forward?
Yeah. So first of all, the most basic answer is nationalism got a bad name because of World War II, basically, and because of the Nazis.
No, it's not the socialism part. It's just
Right. So, so you can't call yourself a nationalist because they're a national socialist, but Bernie can call himself a socialist, even though they're a national socialist. And, you know, Hitler, you could have a whole hour on Hitler alone, and I'm not an expert, but the basic story there is if Hitler had just been a nationalist, he wouldn't have been Hitler. I mean, what made him Hitler was this lunatic racial vision of, you know, Aryans ruling Germany and ruling all of Europe. So it becomes a kind of neo-imperial project. So what's happened, though, is, and what's unprecedented is it used to be that cosmopolitan attitude kind of characterized the critics of society. So you had Diogenes, the first man that's ever recorded saying, I'm a citizen of the world, you know, lived in a pot in the marketplace in Athens to kind of outrage the bourgeoisie of the time. He was an outrageous outsider. And this attitude, though, beginning in this country in the 60s and the 70s, began to creep into the elite. Then you've had business and technological innovations that in the 19th century, they created a more of a national affiliation over and above local affiliations that used to trump all. Now you have these business and technological innovations that have created a transnational affiliation among the business elite and others above a national affiliation. You sort of put those together and we get something that's never existed before, a denationalizing elite that is hostile to our own nation in really important respects. And
is it hostility or is it indifference?
I think it's hostility. You know, it's both, but I think it's hostility. Just to give you an example, you know, the 1619 Project in the New York Times, which focused on slavery, says the founding of the country in effect was in 1619 when the first African-American slave was brought here. And I think it has a lot of good points and important aspects that's important to underline, but it's deeply dishonest. And it's telling lies about ourselves and lies about our history. And then the natural human tendency is to lie about the other guy, right? Mm-hmm. If you're the French, you lie about the Germans. Not that you necessarily need to lie about them very much to make them look badly.
Right, true.
And the Germans do the opposite. To lie about yourself and your own country and try to delegitimize it, that is something totally new and totally radical.
Why does it work? Though, why is it's not working uniformly, thank God, but it does have a natural constituency. We have it better than any human beings who have ever lived. Yeah. 200 years ago, 150 years ago, you cut your finger, that could lead to an infection that could cost your arm or your life.
Right.
Now we don't wake up every morning hunting for food and hoping to make it through the day without getting killed or dying so we can do it again tomorrow. Right. Yet, to hear many people who, when you say the word nationalism, if you gave a speech on a college campus, would plug their ears, run to a safe space, and play with Play-Doh and a puppy. Yeah. We've never had it so good, yet we can't accept it, some people. And why does this contrary message, not only to history and definition of words, but to the reality we see every day, work?
Yeah, so totally with you. One of the foremost feelings we should all have is just gratitude, just incredible gratitude, because none of us did anything to be born here, right? Maybe our parents did if they're immigrants, but we didn't. And it's the most incredible blessing in all of human history. So that part is left out by a lot of people. And then they just focus on the story of America as one of unrelieved oppression and woe. And they think there's something small-minded about a loyalty to a distinct bounded entity, which I think is also completely wrong, because a loyalty to the nation is a loyalty over and above your sect, your ethnicity, your race, your partisanship. It's something we can all belong to and should, rightly understood, be unifying. And that's lost because a lot of people purport to have this world citizen perspective, which to me is a complete lie. There's no such thing. It's a fantasy. To put it in really basic terms, you know, if you get kidnapped by pirates somewhere around the world doesn't save you, right? Your country comes and saves you. Your country negotiates a ransom. Now, it might be maybe the United States comes to save you because we're extremely generous, but your country cares about you more than anyone else. So there's no such thing as a universal nation, a universal language, a universal military. We're all caught up in these particular affiliations and associations, no matter how much we might want to believe that's not true.
What is the natural progression for nationalism? We come from tribes, come from small groups that banded together, bigger groups, larger groups, formed nation states. Is the citizen of the world the next step in that progression, if it were allowed to continue in an ideal situation, which will never exist because human beings are involved? But is there a next step, or is this the finish line?
Well, you have, you know, you have tribes, you have principalities, city states, nation states, and empires. I mean, there's kind of the categories. And people, I think, who focus on the nation state all say that's uniquely awful. It's uniquely associated with warfare. It's just not true. Tribes are the worst. You know, there are tribes in the Amazon right now where 30% of the deaths are caused by violence and warfare. Empires. It's not as though empires were peace-loving. You know, the Roman Empire, they're just a couple of years in its entirety of its history. It wasn't at war in some form or other. And I think the reason why now, you know, knock on wood, we've had for 5 decades or so, a relative period of incredible international peace and order is because the nation state is now taken as a legitimate feature of the international system with sacrosanct borders. And that's now the international norm. It's honored in the breach in some instances. But having that has created a more stable system. Because you don't have it, again, it depends on force. You know, the Habsburg Empire lasted for 600 years, really long time, right in the center of Europe with a lot of nations in it, but it was known as the Prison House of Nations for a reason. Because as soon as the repressive apparatus wanted to lifted, you know, Hungary and all the other nations go their own way. Same thing more recently in the 20th century with the Soviet Union. As soon as they can no longer control those nations, they want to go their own way. And people, again, they feel a natural affiliation with people with whom they share a common language and a common history and a common culture. And this, to circle around to Trump, I think the best speech of his presidency was a speech he gave in Warsaw about Poland, which was a nationalistic speech, making the point that Poland, even though it was situated and has been situated in the worst place in Europe, you know, has been trampled by armies east and west and occupied and partitioned, you never could do away with it because the Poles are so Polish. And Rousseau made this point too, when they're occupied by Russia at some point in the 18th century. Stay true to your own culture and your own mores and your own traditions, and they'll never be able to eliminate you. And that's been true. And I think that's a profound insight.
You think that's why, like, we used to be, it's a joke, but it's true that we used to be a melting pot, and now we're told, don't come here, live in an enclave. In the turn of the 20th century, there was Little Italy, there was a Chinatown, there were all these ethnic enclaves, particularly in New York where you live. But those were not viewed by immigrants as landing strips. They were launching pads. You come here without any knowledge of the language or the culture. You get as much of it as quickly as you possibly can in those enclaves. So you could then go out and become an American from there. We've gone in the opposite direction now.
Right.
We're telling you, live in your enclave. Bring your culture with you. We must celebrate diversity. Which diversity isn't an accomplishment. I'm not really sure why any, you know, we're different skin tones. Congratulations. Like, what are we celebrating there? Why, when it comes to the nationalism, the positive nationalism, and you see a situation where it's butting up against a political agenda of the left and a lot of your friends. When you first started writing this book, I imagine a lot of your friends, even on the right, even at National Review, were like, "What are you doing?"
Yeah, there's a friend I have who's part of a libertarian oriented group, and he literally said, "Don't do that. Don't do that. You know, you're crazy. It's too radioactive. Don't do it."
And it's all because of the adjectives ascribed to it. And it's the white nationalism. It's been weaponized in another way. When Donald Trump says, "I'm a nationalist," at a rally, there is a certain segment of the Morning Joe crowd that hears dog whistles every 5 minutes, like they're Pete Townsend with their tinnitus.
Right.
And immediately ascribe nefarious purposes to it. But the positive impacts of nationalism, I want to get into the negative side of it and the negative modifiers, but the positive aspects of it. Talk about how nationalism is a good thing and the flack that you got when the book, before it was written, was a concept and somebody you've known forever calls up, you're writing a book about it positively about nationalism. What the hell is wrong with you?
Right. Well, first of all, to bring it just much more into the American context. So we wouldn't have had a revolution without nationalism because the revolution at its bottom is what it says is there's American nation, which I believe existed prior to 1776, and we should govern ourselves. And the Declaration, the Atlantic Charter, all these things basically say that a nation has its own rights and claims over and above the government. The government exists to serve the nation, not the other way around. You don't get the Constitution without Hamilton and Washington and others who believe very strongly that if you were just a bunch of squabbling statelets without a coherent national government, that we're going to fall into disrepute and be picked apart by European powers on our periphery. And the Hamiltonian division, the American tradition goes, a nationalist tradition goes right back to him. And you know, he believed we need to have a strong, capable government. We need to have a strong military, particularly a strong navy. And we need to be a great power like Great Britain. Again, that's nationalism. Civil War, classic example, right? Lincoln believes in the preservation of the nation state above almost anything else. Because he believes liberty inheres in the idea of the American nation state. And fights, you know, a war where what 700,000 people die to preserve the American nation state.
One question about that: you look at the Civil War as sort of the real birth in this country of nationalism, because before then, if you go to a Civil War cemetery, it's the Michigan Brigade or whatever. It's the Massachusetts. They almost in many ways. Robert E. Lee couldn't lead the Union Army because Virginia was his country.
Right.
After that, there seemed to be a shift. We are a nation, not a group of states bound together.
Yeah, so it was more ambiguous prior to the Civil War. I mean, we were definitely a nation state and had a national government, but it was more ambiguous, and it definitely cemented the legitimacy of the American nation state. And the Southern nationalism, I believe, was spurious. It was, you know, there's no natural, real geographic boundaries, no different history, no different language, no different founders. It was all about preserving chattel slavery. So I believe in the right of revolution. If you're being treated unjustly, the South wasn't being treated unjustly. They're treating a lot of people unjustly and feared that the growing power of the North would interfere with their rights to treat people unjustly.
One of the things you write about in the case for nationalism is culture. That's always a touchstone in a multicultural society. But you touched on it a little bit, the two Americans who run in.
Right.
Anybody who's been to Europe has sort of experienced that, where you're in a subway car, you're on a bus, you're in a restaurant, and you overhear English, the distinct American English.
Right.
And you kind of look around and you're like, hey, it's like, I know that guy, even though you don't know that guy.
Yeah, right.
But talk a little bit about the culture, because that's a fine line. And when you say that you're talking about culture, a lot of ears perk up. A lot of people get very nervous or angry, depending on which side of the aisle they're on. But there is a distinct American culture. It is wildly important to us as Americans. And I think we're so immersed in it, we're unaware of it. And getting outside of it and looking back at it, I think, is wildly important to see how it's being ruined, manipulated, and weaponized in a lot of ways.
So it's American culture, first of all. Right? Mm-hmm. It's not white. It's not black. It's not anything else. It's all mixed up, and it's American. And the root of it is the language, which, you know, we couldn't be doing this podcast. It would be much harder if we didn't speak the same language. Mm-hmm. The same thing is true of society. If you have a bunch of different languages, I write in the book about Canada, nice, pleasant, even-keeled place to a fault,
They're up to something. I grew up in Detroit. I watch these people from across the river. There's something going on.
But they're almost torn apart by Quebec wanting to go its own way, largely because Quebec's a French-speaking province, you know, plopped into this English-speaking country. Look at what's going on in Spain right now with the contention over the status of Catalonia, again, because they speak their own language and they have their own culture based around that language. So English, absolutely essential. Our founders, our heroes, our mores, our rituals and symbols. You know, I spent a lot of time talking about the flag. This is another instance where the Civil War is really important. We're the most flag-soaked country in the world, and that largely happened during and in the aftermath of the Civil War. where some people called the Civil War at the time the war for the flag. You have all these amazing examples of guys winning the Medal of Honor, but color sergeants, you know, who literally died for the flag. It's not like in a metaphorical sense, like literally. You're not taking this from me, and I'm holding it up no matter what.
We've seen the reenactments, but we know that it's true that it was everybody's going in with a weapon except for the guy carrying the flag. And
exactly.
You're like, I'm not really sure I want to be that guy, you know, because when it gets down to it, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and they're really important rallying points because it gets, you know, the battlefields are filled with smoke and you don't know where to go. And you just read amazing stories. One guy shot, hands it over to the other guy. He holds it up, he shot, hands it over to the other guy. And so it goes. And then finally, our history. And I just think that's really under assault. Two prongs. One is just ignoring it, not teaching it. The other is teaching it as a lie. And using it as a way to delegitimize our own national project. So this American culture, though, it's organic and it's open. You know, it's not as though immigrants can't come here and speak English. They do come here and speak English. I think there are various things we can do now to make sure that keeps happening, but they can do it. And I have a friend met him in college through another friend who was an Indian immigrant brought here, you know, he's 3 or 4 years old and taught himself English by looking at watching TV as a kid. And we used to joke, like, he was more American than I was. He knew more American references than I did. So this is an open culture. It's organic. It changes. You know, when I grew up in the DC area, there was one Mexican restaurant within, you know, reasonable driving distance. And it was like a treat to go there. I remember once I asked, for my birthday, can we go to this Mexican restaurant? Now, you know, there's a Chipotle every 10 blocks.
Right.
So that's a change. But
out there are vomiting into their coffee. Chipotle is not Mexican, but we get the idea.
but it goes how to melting. The melting pot is not rigid. You know, it has some give to it, but there has to be a core. And when I talk about American culture, what I'm talking about is that core.
But when you say something like a common language and the importance of a common language, I agree, I get it. But playing devil's advocate, that would be viewed as a form of cultural imperialism, even though, you know, you go to somebody else's swimming pool and you like to skinny dip and they have a rule that no skinny dipping, you kind of have to play by their rules.
That's my pool because you're winning, Derek. If I had a pool, that would be my rule.
Nobody's going to be skinny dipping in this. You have places that are conquered where their language is wiped out. Yeah. Ireland, one of my favorite places in the world. There are still little enclaves where their language is allowed. But there is a lot of resentment to the idea that there has to be any assimilation done when somebody comes to a country, common language or not. Because you literally – one of my favorite stories, it was probably 2014, 2012, somewhere in there. A janitor in New Jersey won a $400 million Powerball thing. A big deal. Congratulations to him. It wasn't me, jerk. But he'd been in the country since 1988. At his press conference, because New Jersey didn't allow him to be anonymous, he needed a translator. He'd been in the country that long and still needed a translator. Now, he was gainfully employed, not exactly upwardly mobile. He'd been a janitor the entire time. But when you come up against somebody, when you say common language, learn the language, be able to communicate, there is a push in this country that is, again, cultural imperialism. The importance of culture cannot be overstated, and you tied on that because it is what bonds us together. But it's being torn apart a little bit, or at least bastardized, and the name of tolerance, which, again, is... Well, I'm going on too long with this complicated question.
I get exactly what you're getting at. So a classic instance of this, like 6 months ago or whatever it was, Tom Brokaw on Meet the Press says the Hispanics, you know, and the definite article is not great. Definite article showed age.
Right.
I don't think it showed malice, but definitely showed age. Need to work more to assimilate. And there's a huge blow up. And you had people, you know, not just saying, well, you know, you shouldn't have said the, and this was kind of a tone deaf comment, saying there's something wrong. This is what you're getting at. About saying that people coming here have to give up their culture for our culture. But to me, we're permitting them in this country, you know, immigrants, and a lot of them were not deliberately doing it. They're just coming in. We have no means to exclude them. It's the least you can ask. And it doesn't mean that you can't, you know, teach your kids your native language at home. It doesn't mean that you can't be feel a particular attachment to the cuisine and the history and learn about it and follow more in the news than you would any other country. But it does mean that you need to adopt kind of this core mainstream culture. And again, it's not hard. People do it. And you're right. In the early 20th century, we had these ethnic enclaves. One reason they broke down is we had this incredible machinery of assimilation. Every elite institution in American life was in favor of this, supportive of this Americanization movement in the early 20th century. And we also, beginning in 1924, for some not great reasons, people supported this Immigration Restriction Act for racist reasons, a lot of them, but we reduced numbers. And when you're not reinforcing the ethnic enclaves get smaller and break down because there's not some, Italian-American girl coming fresh off the boat who you can marry as a recent Italian-American immigrant, you got to look elsewhere. So you get out marriage, which is really the ultimate means of assimilation and kind of mixing us all up together into one pot, which is what I hope keeps happening.
When it comes, there are the battle of two different terms, both with a sullied history, or at least sullied portions of their history. One is nationalism, one is progressivism. I would argue that progressivism is by far the worst history, given eugenics for one, but
right.
the concept wise of the ruling elite should be able to dictate who can exist, essentially.
Right.
Yet one has been demonized and other is embraced. I never understood. Let's just say that there's the Derek Hunter Society. I'll just bring it back to me. Long before I came along, there was the Derek Hunter Society, and it was a horrible racist society. And then it kind of faded away. And then 50 years later, somebody goes, you know what? I'm going to recreate the Derek Hunter Society. We're going to do it different this time.
Right.
We're not going to have the racism aspect of it, but the rest of it we're going to bring to it. Most people would say that's a ridiculous idea. You want to start a new society, call it something else or whatever. But the progressive movement has this racist history, more so than the idea, the concept of nationalism. Yet every Democrat running for president, I'm a strong progressive, I want to bring about progressive this, progressive that. How has that term survived while nationalism has been demonized?
Because they just don't, either they don't know their own history,
or
they don't own up to the sins of their own history.
And
it's sort of bizarre, right, that they took what I consider, now it's under stress on the right as we speak, but perfectly fine word, liberal, and rejected that as somehow having bad connotations and instead globbed on to progressive. A mainstream Democrat was not describing him or herself as a progressive, 5-6 years ago. It's kind of a recent thing. But one thing that they believe 110% to the marrows of their bones is that their intentions are pure and ours aren't.
Of course. That's how they can get up in the morning. That's how history's greatest monsters became who they were. Not that I'm immune to it or any human being is immune to it. They always think the best of themselves. When I told a few people, I'm talking to Rich Lowry today about his new book, in support of nationalism, so on and so forth. A couple of them looked at me and they had various forms of the same sort of question, because nationalism right now is associated most closely with Donald Trump. Famously, in 2016, National Review put out the Never Trump issue, which I was upset that I would have been right on board at that time. The realities have changed things, obviously, and I think the way he governed has more hands-off than anything else, but the results I like. There's still that rift on the right.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still that rift in National Review itself. How do you write how do you exist in that world? Because you were a signatory to the Never Trump world, but now you're not a pro-Trumper, you're not a bandwagoner, you're not an always Trumper. You exist in this gray area in between. How did that transition come about for you? I know how it came about for me, but I'm curious for you.
Yeah. So first of all, just a couple of little things. It was against Trump issue, not
okay.
Trump issue.
That's right. I remember the font more than I remember the words.
And I never described myself as Never Trump, although other people described me as it, and I didn't object. But the term always struck me as kind of too categorical.
Mm-hmm.
But all that aside, in the primaries, we desperately wanted to defeat him, and we threw everything we had at him as an opinion magazine. You know, we weren't a super PAC with $100 million to do an ad buy, but we used every element of force we had, and we failed, and he was elected. And you go from a situation where there are 16 better alternatives, maybe not all 16 were better, but most of them were better in our view, to a situation where there are no alternatives. There are no Republican alternatives. People who might have thought Mark Sanford was an alternative, you know, he did, I guess, one campaign event that I heard about.
One guy showed up to, and I think he just woke up there.
And now he shuttered the campaign. And the alternative is, you know, maybe Elizabeth Warren coming down the track with a $50 trillion healthcare plan. So that's influenced my thinking that I like 70, 80%, I don't know where it is, of the substance. Is important, especially like on some really key things like abortion and conscious rights that I never would have expected. It's
right.
Still, it's a minor miracle that Donald Trump has been like a rock on those things. But then here, this is why I end up in this, I like you describing this little gray space that I'm in, is I think, you know, a lot of the conduct and the things he says are appalling, and a president shouldn't say or do them.
Shouldn't, yes. But you watch CNN, and Donald Trump tweets out, there's a meme of Donald Trump tackling Vince McMahon from the 90s with a CNN logo over his head, and they all clutch their pearls, and they can't believe it. Why I never, this is a threat to democracy, we're scared for our existence. Barack Obama actually tapped the phones of 20 Associated Press reporters. They tapped the email of James Rosen's parents to find out who his sources were. They put James Rosen in prison. I mean, there were actual literal threats to freedom of the press. And that, I think, is a nice illustration of the idea that so many people have about Donald Trump. It's not what he does. It's what he says. A tweet is not policy. A tweet is nothing more than perhaps a pressure cooker letting off some of the steam. And I would suggest that what he does, while not a principled conservative, certainly not doctrinaire conservative, I think he'd sign almost any piece of legislation Congress put in front of him and sell it like it's the greatest thing. And I think that's Congress's biggest folly, his entire presidency, is that they didn't do more because they would have had to not have to sell it. But when it comes to the actions, more so than words, Donald Trump gets the exact opposite treatment of Barack Obama. He'd give a very flowery speech, and then he will tap the phones. He will target, use the IRS to go after his political opponents. And on the right, there seems to be the left, I get. This is why they do it. He's a Republican. He's against them. But so many on the right are stuck on his words more so than his deeds.
Yeah. So a couple things. So I totally agree with you on the hysteria over the tweets. You can't violate the First Amendment.
They're unpresidential. There's no question about it.
Right.
But so what? Because he's governing in a way that is much more conservative than George W. Bush was in many ways.
So the people who say, you know, because he attacks the press or calls the press the enemy, the people, which I don't think should do, they're somehow violating the First Amendment or violating the Constitution. He's not. And you're completely right also about, you know, Barack Obama rewrote immigration law on his own.
Mm-hmm.
This was a flagrant violation of the separation of powers and a flagrantly unconstitutional act. There's nothing, zero peeps. I don't remember one Democrat in Congress. I don't remember anyone on the center left saying, oh gosh, you know, we support the goal, but he doesn't have the authority to do this.
In the lead up, they were begging him to do it.
Right.
Ben Cardin begged him to do it.
Yeah. And then same thing with the Warren. You know, we look at now the reaction to what Trump did in Ukraine, and a lot of talk about norms and respect for legislative authority and overreaching executive power used in a personal way. But here's Elizabeth Warren saying she's going to ban fracking, you know, on day one, that she doesn't have the authority to do, saying she's going to impose a wealth tax, dubious constitutionality at best, break up the tech companies. What is her authority to do that? And again, not a peep. So the hypocrisy drives me crazy as well. And then I do feel I'm a human being, so like a lot of Republicans, I just feel the push. I watch CNN or MSNBC for 15 minutes. I'm like, you know, I want to walk the precincts for the guy.
I know.
Crazy. But I still get down to there are things he says and does that he shouldn't, that are wrong. I'm going to say it. Some of my colleagues are going to say it, even, you know, in a more voluminous or hair on fire kind of way. And I think where a lot of people comes down on them, I think there are a couple breakdowns. One, if you're not into gun rights, if you're not pro-life, if you're not a restrictionist, then, you know, you sort of, I would characterize, I don't know where Brett Stevens is on all of those things, but there's not a huge upside to Trump for you, right? Mm-hmm. So that dictates some critics being in a different place. And then also just how much harm you attribute to the statements and the conduct and how much emphasis you put on the character, that also dictates where you are on the spectrum.
You've been at National Review for some time. National Review has been a pillar, in many ways, the tip of the spear of the conservative world. The conservative world seems, not only in Trump, it kind of lost its soul. I started at the Heritage Foundation in 2001, right out of college. Under George W. Bush, we looked the other way on a lot of spending issues. We pretended that, you know, deficits don't matter. It's spending that matters. And then we did nothing about spending either. The conservative movement is now kind of at war with itself. The economy is booming. The deficits have almost never been higher. After Trump, and not because of Trump, but after, I think when any president, whoever it happens to be, you're going to get more of the same. You're going to need somebody new afterwards. After Trump, where does the conservative movement go? Were we all just sold a bill of goods in the 90s? And the concept of the 80s, what we were told in the 80s was Reagan, he cut taxes, revenue grew, but the spending cuts never came. And we were told that's why the deficits bloomed. Well, we've been through enough cycles now and enough absolute control where nobody seems interested. You can't complain about Democrats doing spending when you're doing the same thing. Is the conservative movement dead, I guess, in the way it is? Does it need to be reconstituted? Where does it go from here?
I think there are a lot of things we need to rethink. And this is why I welcome a lot of the internal debate on the right, even though it's uncomfortable. You know, some of the fires directed at National
Review. But there's no such soul-searching on the left. It's doctrinaire on abortion up until birth, and then, you know, the argument is, should we go 6 months after birth? That's about the amount of debate that they'll tolerate on it, yet...
There's some, and they, astonishingly enough, they concluded that Barack Obama was a sellout,
right,
in effect, and wasted his presidency because he didn't do enough. But this is one reason I wrote the book, is I want people who are not necessarily into Trump, I want Trump folks to be able to read it and say, okay, that's the truth about nationalism, that's why it's okay. But I want people who are very skeptical of the president or opposed also to read it and maybe conclude, well, when he's gone, there should still be a nationalistic aspect to our program. But I think the party is going to have to be more nationalist, more populist, reflecting this large change that's happened that was accelerated by Trump but not caused by him, which is college-educated whites in the suburbs sliding away from the party and working-class whites coming in to the party. And I think, even though it seems strange to say, that a Trump-oriented, more nationalist, populist message has more potential to jump racial lines than like a Mitt Romney, conventional, stereotypical Republican Party does. Because I think they're African-American, Latino, working-class, middle-class males in particular that would find this program particularly appealing if it's presented them to the right way and if the party works at it hard. But there's a lot that just needs to be worked out and thought through. And we have a great kind of abstract debate going, but we don't have a very specific debate going about, you know, what are our new policies that match this moment.
One of the things that drove me nuts when I was at Heritage, when I worked in the Senate, when I worked at Americans for Tax Reform, is the libertarians. I kind of, various points in my life, considered myself libertarian. And I began to see someone like Bill Maher call himself a libertarian, mm-hmm, too. Bill Maher is not a libertarian. He wants to smoke weed and sleep with hookers.
Right.
That doesn't make you a libertarian.
Right.
But then I came to the realization that there is no what a libertarian is. So Bill Maher could call himself a libertarian. In places like Reason and Cato, where I have a lot of friends who work and they do great work, they weren't willing to stand up and say, no, you're not a libertarian. Here's what it means to be a libertarian. is somebody going to stand up and sort of draw the line? This is what it means to be a conservative. These, it doesn't have to be everything. You don't have to have every branch on the tree, every ornament hung on it. But these are the core principles that if you don't at least have a basket half full of these things, then you're not really a conservative. You could be center right. You could be lots of other things. But the term has to have meaning or it is meaningless. And the National Review sort of helped define what conservatism is. So it's not really much of a question, as I'm begging you, Rich Lowry, please, somebody, don't let us go the way of the libertarians where you can have somebody like an Anna Navarro calling herself a conservative Republican, and then it loses all meaning.
Right. Well, this is where I think the key difference between conservative and libertarians in a very schematic way. So a libertarian tends to view society through the prism of the individual and the state, right? And that's the key relationship that moves history. It's key relationships that determines whether we're free or not. And there's a lot to that. But what it leaves out is something that the last 10 years or so has become clear, even though this has always been a conservative insight, but it's become more obvious in a practical way that really matters. And that's the in-between. That's civil society. Those, all those mediating institutions between the individual and the state. Again, this is not a new insight. You know, it goes back to Burke or even further. And what we've seen in certain parts of the country is a total erosion of those mediating institutions, people kind of checking out of those institutions and being like more individualistic, right? But it doesn't make them happier. If you're not plugged into the workforce, if you're not plugged into church, if you're not plugged into volunteer organizations, and importantly, if you're not plugged into marriage, if you're an individual in that sense, you know, maybe Bill Maher is different, someone with a lot of means is different, but you're probably unhappy. And this is where you get these communities that are beset by these deaths of despair, alcoholism, drug abuse, suicide. So conservatism has to be about freedom, and it also needs to be about virtue. And freedom comes in that relationship between the individual and the state. I was just talking about virtue comes from those from that middle part, the civil society. And where I object what some so-called post-liberals are saying is they think that the government can help in some really fundamental way in that virtue piece. And I'm just highly skeptical of that.
The complete lack of evidence to support that is sort of a giveaway. Two last questions for you as we wrap it up with you for the case for nationalism. When you set out to write a book, I know how it is. You have preconceived notions. You have an outline in your head. What in the course of your research, and there's a lot of research, a lot of footnotes at the end of the book, what surprised you the most? What did you learn writing this book?
How old one national feeling is. I talked about Joan of Arc, all sorts of other examples. Ancient Israel is an example, a religion, but also had all the hallmarks of a nation. The laws were important. The borders are important. There's, I don't know whether it's in, I forget which chapter of the Bible it is, but there's a long passage where God basically, it's almost like he's a surveyor. You know, here's your border, goes around this hill, down through this valley, over this hill, this way and all the way around. So how old it was, it really struck me. And then also I had like a seed of sympathy for colonial empires, like Britain, you know, a great country, kind of a liberalizing empire in certain respects. But no, at the end of the day, people just need to govern themselves. And anything that tramples on that is illegitimate and wrong. And then also just on immigration in this country, you know, I'm a restrictionist, but I'm much more inclined to kind of you're in kind of attitude. So I would favor in the right circumstances with the right trade-off even more than I would have before some sort of amnesty for illegal immigrants. I think it's really bad to have a semi-perpetual class of second-class citizens.
What would you think of a perpetual work visa with no pathway to citizenship?
I wouldn't do that either.
No?
No.
It's the vote that bothers me, and it's the vote that I know bothers a lot of people. It's if you don't want to live in the shadows, don't move there. But if you want to come out, you don't get to negate my vote. And that's where I think you lose a lot of people. Lastly, Rich Lowry, before I ask you to sign these, when somebody, Ms. or Z America, closes this book after having just read it, what's the thought you want to have going through their head as they fall asleep that night?
What an amazing blessing this country is, how it's the greatest nation in the history of nations, and how we need to be focused with all of our efforts on preserving it and passing it on. Because, again, we're not just discrete individuals. We're all the beneficiaries of this amazing patrimony, which is handed to us, nothing we did, like a free act of grace, and now we got to hand it on to the next generation.
The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United and Free by Rich Lowry. I'm going to ask you to sign these. And if you want to enter to win a signed copy, email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. Let me know that you want that. You're just not telling me to go to hell or whatever. And if you've bought a copy or buy a copy, send me a screen capture of your receipt or just a picture of you holding it up. You'll be entered twice. So you can't beat that. Rich, congratulations on the book, sir. And thanks for coming in.
Really appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thanks for watching, reviewing, ratings, sharing, and all that good stuff. Don't forget to subscribe and be back here on Monday. Have a great weekend. Thanksgiving's coming. We'll see you then.
Well, there you go. There's the interview with Rich Lowry. Love it or hate it. I found it very interesting. In the middle of these things, I can tell if it's a good interview or a bad interview, and this was a really good interview. I enjoyed talking to him immensely. I know that a lot of you, when you hear National Review, you get a little nervous. I get it. But I don't think that that's necessarily founded. Draw your own conclusions, though. You can do that. And if you want to enter to win a signed copy of his book, you just email me, Derek@dailycaller.com, and you shall be entered. And again, the rules apply that if you've purchased a copy or do purchase a copy, you send me a copy, a screen capture of the receipt from an online retailer, or just a picture of you holding the book, and you'll get entered twice. So there you go. I'll have two copies to give away the week after Thanksgiving. So not next week, just because it's an abbreviated week. Give people more time to enter and all of that. Plus, there's going to be like a best of interview show next week, next Friday. So there you go. Because Black Friday is my holiday. I love Black Friday. It's a sickness. I don't even need anything. I just feel compelled to participate. Maybe it's the prospect of trampling somebody. I don't know what it is. Actually, I just love a bargain. Anyway, without any further ado, the winners of the Jerome Hudson signed book this round are, in no particular order, Kimberly Powers. Congratulations, Kimberly Powers. And Sean Mills. Congratulations, Sean Mills. You guys will be getting emails from me asking for your actual physical address, and I will send that book out to you as soon as I possibly can. Should have some time next week, hopefully, to get all the mailings done, because I've been lacking on that, too. Oh, now that's it for the week. The weekend has officially started. Well, not for me. I have to do 3 hours of radio on WCBM from 9 to noon on Friday today. Then the weekend actually doesn't even start then, because I have to write a column Friday night. But then the weekend starts. And by the weekend, I mean Saturday, because I have to work Sunday to get ready to do the podcast and write a column and get ready to do radio. God, my life sucks. Actually, it doesn't. It's pretty damn good. Thank you for listening, telling a friend, spreading the word. The Patreon website, if you're so inclined to help out, is patreon.com/Derek Hunter Podcast. Every little bit helps. You guys help. Telling friends and all that. Next week is Thanksgiving. Can't wait for that. I'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Mom, she probably can't hear me. Mom, can you hear me?